Matthew chapter 20. Before we dive in, which we will in just a moment, I just want to kind of just get some sort of the lay of the land, actually quite literally the lay of the land, just for a moment. Because sometimes when we read scripture, we're maybe not as familiar with sort of what's going on around sort of the context of it, even sometimes the locations of it, and some of the implications of that stuff. So before I actually start into the sermon, which we will get to, this is just preface to, I just want to kind of bring you to a map. Just for two reasons. The first, I don't know if you ever heard anyone who maybe you've talked about your faith with who have said something like, well, the Bible is just full of so many inconsistencies I could never believe. Because it's like, there's just way too many of them and there's details that are wrong. And so, you know what? It's just kind of fairy tales and hogwash. Anyone ever heard that? A few of us. Okay. This is one of them. And I just wanted to introduce it to you in case you've never heard this one. In the Gospel of Matthew, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell this same story. Matthew and Mark give this detail. You heard the scripture read earlier, but it was verse 29, as they went out of Jericho. And so this scene, as Matthew tells it, is the scene of Jesus coming across two blind men who are at the side of the road begging after he leaves Jericho. Luke, when he tells the story, talks about the fact that Jesus, on his way into Jericho, encounters two blind beggars and the same story happens. And some people are like, you see, it's just another example. They can't even get the details of their story right. And if you can't get your facts right, then why would we listen to any of it? So let me just explain what's going on here. Anyone heard of like places where there's like an old town and a new town? It's not actually that uncommon. We first lived as a married couple in a place called Sparwood. Have you ever been through it? The big green truck. That's about the only claim to fame. There was Lower Sparwood that was started like quite a few decades earlier than Upper Sparwood. We lived in Upper Sparwood. Two kind of different communities. You actually had to leave, get on the highway, and drive to. Now, if you were talking about it, it's like, I live in Sparwood. I didn't make a distinction. We lived in Upper Sparwood, kind of almost like a different little place than Lower Sparwood. Jericho in the Old Testament is the northern version of that. And if you remember back in the book of Joshua, the Israelites come across the Jordan River. They march around the city and God in his power knocks the walls down. And it's the beginning of Israel claiming the land that God has given to them. That is the old Jericho, northern Jericho. It was eventually semi-rebuilt. So it wasn't abandoned. It was for a while, but eventually there is some construction. And there are now people inhabiting old Jericho. But about a mile south of it, New Jericho starts up, a brand new city that didn't exist formerly. It starts up largely around the balsam industry, which sounds weird. Like, what on earth are they doing? Balsam was believed to be, in the ancient world, one of the key eye medicines. So they would use it as a salve, take the sap out of the trees and treat people, which is going to, it probably figures into the story of like, why are these blind people all in the proximity of Jericho? They would typically, that's where communities would spring up of people who had eye issues because they're going there for the latest state-of-the-art treatment that's coming out of the city of Jericho. And so if you're picturing like, how does this story work? We're probably between old and new Jericho. So Jesus has gone through Jericho. So you could properly say as he left Jericho, but you could also very easily look at the same story and go as he is entering into Jericho because he is between these two towns. So it's stuff like that oftentimes that people who will throw those comments to you are like, you know what, the Bible's just full of these stories that they just don't make any sense. It's like, just go and just sometimes read the passage. Do just a little bit of research because probably what you will find is most of them actually are quite obviously resolved and they're not problems at all. But anyway, that's the first reason. But the main thing I want you to see as we think through this next scene is, again, back to the Old Testament. If you can think through the story that some of you would have maybe, if you went to Sunday school growing up, you probably know this story of the Exodus and the Israelites come out of Egypt. And it's only really a two-week walk from, you know, Egypt to this part of the world now that we know as Israel. But because of their sin, and their rebellion against God, they end up wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. Finally, at the end of that wandering on the east side of the Jordan River, they gather there at a mountain. That's where Moses dies, and then Joshua takes over, and they cross the Jordan. It's one of God's miracles to hold up that river so they can get across. The very first city they encounter is Jericho. As we just talked about a few minutes ago, God works in power there. All that to say, if you arrive at this area of the world and you are a Jewish person, I guarantee you there are stories going through your mind. In fact, Jesus and his disciples are following the well-known route from Galilee, which would have been, see that little blue river, the Jordan River? Just out of picture, just north of that, would have been the Sea of Galilee, which most of the stories of Jesus and his disciples take place in that proximity. They're on the water, they're on the shore, all the cities, you know, Bethsaida, Capernaum, Nazareth, all those places that we might have heard in Bible stories, all around the sea. Then they are going to travel down to Jerusalem. Passover time, back in chapter 16 of Matthew, Jesus has announced it's time to go up to Jerusalem. And so they start this journey. They're with crowds because everyone's going to Passover. It's just what you did if you were a Jewish person at that time of year. But they will not travel on the left side, the west side of that river, because it would take them through Samaritan land, and they just will not, as a custom, the Israeli people will not pass through it. So they cross over the river. They come down what is known as Perea, or actually they often refer to it as beyond the Jordan. It's just like the other side of the Jordan. They come down the Jordan River, then they have to cross back over the Jordan River, follow this road that you can kind of see that crosses the Jordan, leads to Jericho, and then it's the southern branch that leads them down to Jerusalem. All that to say, isn't it interesting that Jesus, whose name actually is the same name as Joshua, which means God saves, is now with a large crowd, having just crossed the Jordan River and entered into Jericho on his way to Jerusalem. And I have no doubt in my mind that the crowds of people following him are going, something big is about to happen. It's almost like we are reliving the Exodus, right down to the physical geography. They would have walked past some of the landmarks the people of Israel had set up generations before to remind them of what God had done in these various spots. And as they came to Jerusalem, you almost wonder, I wonder where the crowds are like, I wonder what Jesus is going to do. Remember when Joshua, like we know our story, Joshua arrived at Jericho and just crushed it. I wonder what Jesus is going to do when he arrives at Jericho. Keep that piece in mind as we start navigating through the story. Just one more backdrop piece, and then we're going to get into this little passage. If you have your Bible and can flip real quick to Isaiah chapter 35. Matthew has drawn heavily from Isaiah. Matthew would have had huge, clear roots. He's speaking to a Jewish audience. And so very, very different than, say, Luke, who is speaking to clearly a Greek Gentile audience. Matthew just keeps drawing from the Old Testament. It's just rich, particularly the book of Isaiah. And so we've looked at this throughout this series, all the way back from the very beginning, some of the language he uses, the terminology he uses, rich in Isaiah roots. Isaiah 35 is a fascinating chapter, very, very popular chapter. Like if you're a Jewish person and you're like, hey, give us your most popular chapters of Isaiah, 35 is going to be one of them. And as I read a few statements, just kind of keep in mind what's just happened. You remember Jesus has just, he's just had a conversation with two of his disciples, well, actually their mother, who comes, bows down before him, and he asks her a question. If you read carefully, he asks her, what do you want? And she, in response, says, I want my sons, one to sit on the right and one on the left. When you come to your throne, I want them to have the next tier of thrones, essentially. And she's almost like, it's almost like you can kind of imagine, she's picturing this vision of this glorious throne room, and there Jesus, of course, Jesus is going to have the top throne. You can't ask for that one, but it's like, could my boys be one and two next to Jesus? And there's this long conversation between Jesus and the disciples about what it means to be great. Essentially, if we were to summarize it real quick, being great in Jesus' kingdom is not sitting on thrones and measuring your greatness by the number of people bowed down to serve you. Greatness in Jesus' kingdom is actually serving others. Remember how he inverts that whole thing? And he gets to the end of that statement and he says, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's a rich statement, but it's an Isaiah 35 statement. Isaiah 35 verse 10 ends with this sentence, and the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, and everlasting joy will be upon their heads. It's an awesome statement. You probably read it and it's like, oh, I want everlasting joy. I want that kind of peace. But just think of the language for a moment of what Isaiah has just said. He's used ransom language, which is the very word Jesus just went to in chapter 20, verse 28, or 19, verse 28 of Matthew. But where is Jesus geographically at this at the moment he says that? He's on a road, the way to Jerusalem. He's going, that's Zion. That is the same place that Isaiah 35 is talking about. The ransom of the Lord shall return. They will go back to Jerusalem and they will come to Zion with singing. Now, as we work backwards through Isaiah chapter 35, some things start coming to light. Verse 8 says, there will be a highway and it will be called the way of holiness. The unclean will not pass over it. It will belong to those who walk on the way, and even if they're fools, they will not go astray. And so the picture of Isaiah 35 is there's this road and it's leading us back to Zion, back to Jerusalem. And when we get there, there will be eternal joy and peace and celebration. But those who are on the road, on the way to Jerusalem, they're not going to be the unclean. Like this is the road for holy people. Unclean people don't get to come along for this walk. In the ancient world, one of the most unholy people, and we've looked at this before because Jesus keeps encountering blind people. That's not by accident. Again, go through scripture. You will never find a prophet healing a blind person. You will never find an apostle healing a blind person. The healing of the blind is the prerogative of God alone. In fact, it is so strongly that way that it came to be understood that if you were blind, you were actually cursed by God. They didn't just conclude, it's like, oh, some physical, you know, issue came upon you. It's like, no. God struck you. Just think of like places like John chapter 9 where there's this blind guy and everyone's like, who sinned? Him? His family, like someone sinned, because we've done the math in our heads, someone sinned, God struck him blind as a consequence of his sin. That's just the simple one-to-one equation in their minds. You're blind, you're cursed by God. You're unclean, you're unable to enter the temple, you're unable to enter into worship. You're pretty much probably going to be unable to even live with your family and friends because the consequences of blindness are catastrophic in the ancient world. Different, still in our day, it is not an easy condition to face. But if you think of a place where there's not an even road, there's not an even path, there are constant obstacles. And you just start to imagine what that would be like. I mean, your chances of you tripping, the likelihood of infection setting in. I mean, I won't go down that road much more, but you can start to imagine the consequence of this condition and how very easy it is for everyone around you to go, you're cursed by God, you're unclean, we want nothing to do with you. Certainly, you are not going to be a part of the parade that's walking to Jerusalem because those people, those are clean people. Continuing backing up through Isaiah 35, verse 4 says, say to those who have an anxious heart, I don't know if you're like me, but it's like every time I read that in scripture, I'm like, well, I want to know what I'm supposed to think because man, I got an anxious heart sometimes. Here it is. Be strong and fear not. Behold, your God will come. And that's the fascinating thing of Isaiah chapter 35. Isaiah 35 is not about the Messiah will come, the one anointed by God, who is like a human type figure who's going to come and lead you. Isaiah 35 is about God coming. And listen to what he will do when he comes. He will come and he will save you. In verse 5, the first criteria, what do we look for when this is happening? Then the eyes of the blind will be opened. Now, God coming to save, eyes of the blind being open, a path of holy or clean people who will come to Jerusalem because they've been ransomed. You get the language, you get kind of the working of vocabulary in our minds. Now that we've got that, let's jump into this seemingly very simple story that you kind of read and it's like, why is Matthew even telling us this? I mean, all sorts of people are being healed. I mean, just think back over the last couple of chapters, there's crowds of people following Jesus and Matthew would throw out a simple statement like, and Jesus healed all the crowds. And then he picks this singular story and says, this is the one I want you to look at. In fact, he says that very thing in verse 30. Behold, that's instruction to us. That's like, that's a author saying, I'm telling you this story, all these interactions with Jesus, do not miss this one. This one is important. And as they went out to Jericho, great crowds followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. Because that's all that blind people could do. And they would beg from essentially a peasant class of people. I mean, you want to just think through how dire the situation. This is a time in history when most people are just essentially their day laborers. You would go out, you might get work that day. We looked at that story not long ago in chapter 20, the parable Jesus told. You might get enough money to feed your family. And these people are begging from those people. That is a dire situation. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent, but they cried out all the more, "Lord, have mercy on us, son of David." Now, I don't know how they knew or even what they knew in its entirety about Jesus. Maybe they had heard the stories of this man from the Galilee region who had healed other blind people. He had. You can go and read it. They would have known no one can do that. That's actually evidence, again, of the Messiah, of God at work. In fact, Jesus, when he goes into the very first synagogue, the very first sermon he ever preaches, he talks about the day of the Lord, and he talks about coming and preaching good news to the poor. You remember what he adds to it? And sight to the blind. It's Isaiah chapter 61. He's saying, this is being fulfilled. No prophet can do this. No teacher can do this. Only God can do this. And it's evidence in history for the Jewish people. When you see one who comes who can heal the blind, oh, you better pay attention. In fact, that's Jesus' response to John the Baptist in Matthew chapter 11. When Matthew's in jail and his expectations of, did I get it wrong? Is Jesus really the one? And he sends his disciples, if you remember the story, he sends his disciples to Jesus with the question, are you the one or should we expect someone else? And Jesus says, go back and tell them what you've seen. The blind receive their sight. That's the answer. It's like, yes, I am the one. And I'm more than just a mere man. I'm more than just the Messiah. I am God because God is the one who gives sight. And all these pieces are going into this seemingly innocuous little story of two blind men who are about to be healed. And what I want to do this morning, real quick, because I know we don't have a ton of time, I want to kind of fly by four times and just kind of show you four different, I think, layers to the story that are going on that we're supposed to see. I think very clearly, and I'll try to point out why I believe this along the way if I have time, why what Matthew intends for us to see when he says to you and me in verse 30, look at these two men, pay attention. Number one, Jesus does a great miracle. It's more than just like a narrative event where he's wanting to connect some dots and make theological points. Like, never just miss when Jesus shows up and does amazing things. I mean, what would you do if someone's, you know, blind or with one of those, you know, very difficult issues came to you and said, hey, could you heal me? Like, I've often said, it's like, what muscle do you flex to do that? Like, what action do you take? It would be like me every once in a while. I don't know if I've ever had car issues. I'm not much of a mechanic, but like, guys, like, let's pop the hood. Let's look into that thing. I'm like, looking. It's like, unless there's something sticking out somewhere, right? If you came to me and it's like, I'm blind. Unless there's like an object sticking out of your eye, it's like, I don't know where to start. But Jesus instantly heals these two men. And it doesn't even seem like he breaks a sweat. But it's more than that. It's more than just the immense power to accomplish what no one else can accomplish. It's the mercy and compassion. Like, just watch some of the details. We'll get to them crying out for mercy. But just as you read through the story, verse 32 tells us that Jesus stopped and he touched him. And Jesus always has that way about him. He heals many people without touching them. But if you go through and read the stories, it's interesting to me. It's the unclean one. It's the people who would have had an association connected with them that you wouldn't want to have touched them because you would be made unclean. And Jesus just casually always just breaks right through that. He could have just said, you know, restore your sight, but he touches them. He stops. I mean, even that is a bit amazing, isn't it? If you ever watch sort of the news or some, you know, media thing, and there's the great and powerful people of our world, some CEO or some world leader, or even some celebrity, some sports superstar, music superstar, and they get out of the car and there's the entourage with them and there's all the fans behind the stanchions because they're not supposed to get close. And the important people, they just do this. They just walk and people try to touch them and reach out just for a touch, but they don't stop because they're too important. And Jesus, with a crowd following him on his way to Jerusalem, with his own death on his mind, two blind men cry out for mercy. And he stops in his tracks. And he will not move an inch until he has resolved their most desperate need. Verse 34 tells us that Jesus, in pity, I don't That is an inadequate word. I don't have one in English for you. The Greek would say something like he was stirred in his bowels. It was a way of talking about a level of compassion that was both upset over something that was immensely wrong, but moved to do something to fix it. Is that pity? Is it compassion? Like I say, I don't think we have a word in English that just does it justice, but Jesus sees these two men and he stops in his tracks and he heals them with great compassion. That's our Jesus. That's level one. We don't want to miss that. That'd be a shame. Level two. It seems like Matthew is wanting to juxtapose two blind men in the crowd. Almost kind of like watching these two groups. One big group, one very small group. One group that's yelling out, the other's telling them to be quiet. One group that seems focused and fixated on following Jesus to glory in Jerusalem. I was like, we are gonna kick down some gates. We are excited about what this king is going to do because we want him to be a king of glory and power. We want him to be the kind of king that sits way up on a throne and everyone has to grovel at his feet. In fact, there's this interesting story, and we'll look at it next week in chapter 21. My Bible calls it the triumphal entry. I've never been sure what to do with that label because it's almost like an inverted triumphal entry. It's almost like a mock triumphal entry. A triumphal entry is actually, that's a label. And it would have been so understood that if you saw one of these in the ancient world, no one had to say, hey, that's a triumphal entry. You would have just known, what are the features of a triumphal entry? Well, you take the king, typically in this day and age, first century, it's the Caesar, the emperor. You put him on a majestic war stallion. And you cover him with robes. You cover the horse with the finest, cleanest, purest of fabrics. And then you have a parade behind him of all the defeated enemies who are being dragged along in chains. And that king marches victorious. Everyone exits the city and lines the street. And they cheer for their king who shows up with absolute majesty. And he enters the city and he goes to the temple and he offers some sort of sacrifice. Usually it's the loot that he's taken from his enemies. And he takes it in there and he kills it in the temple. And it's this statement of saying, our God beat your God. That's a triumph. And Jesus, you start to see why it's almost like this mockery of this whole thing. He comes into Jerusalem, that's the capital. And he is a king. But there's no war stallion, it's a colt, it's a young donkey. And where's the royal fabric? He's got the coats of peasants who have been following him. No doubt torn and sewn and dirty, and they're putting them on the street. And he rides into Jerusalem. The crowds come out. The crowds, it's very interesting. When you read real carefully through the Gospels, it's almost like they aren't quite sure what to make of it. His followers are all excited and singing and, you know, celebrating this. And then he does exactly what the king's supposed to do. He goes right to the temple. And he cleanses it of all that has been profaning God. It's like, is it a triumphal entry? Oh, it's more triumphant than any other triumphal entry has been. But you understand how different, shockingly different it would have been for those who have been watching this thing. But the crowd wants triumphal entry number one. They want a war stallion and purple fabric and a king who's going to come in and everyone's going to recognize him. But two blind men on the side of the road see him differently. Yes, I said see him. In fact, I think we've talked about this before. Matthew's use of numbers, he doesn't want them to be counted. He wants them to be weighed. It's just a way of saying, when you hear numbers in Matthew, don't just imagine it's like, well, that just means person one and person two. You got to think of like, what, why? Matthew, why would you tell us that? Because Mark doesn't tell us that. Mark just tells us about one man. His name is Bartimaeus, which means son of uncleanliness. Remember Isaiah 35? Who doesn't get to come on this parade? The unclean people. Now we've got the son of uncleanliness. But Matthew doesn't tell us a thing about the names. He just says there's two. That's Deuteronomy 19 in action. It takes two people to be witnesses. How unlikely is this? Matthew's going to enlist two blind men to be witnesses to one of the most amazing, spectacular claims, and they will shout it out at the top of their lungs. That right there is the son of David. Now again, for us, maybe that terminology is unfamiliar. In the Gospel of Matthew, it's used in odd ways because the people who will make that declaration are all the little people. They're the misfits. They're the ones who don't fit. It's a Canaanite woman. It's blind people. It's kind of obscure people who are sort of on the fringes of society. Chapter 21, it's going to be the children. Hosanna, and they'll sing to the Son of David. The only people who will ever put it on their lips who are sort of, they're up there, are the Pharisees later on the story. And they aren't saying it because they believe it. They're saying it because they're challenging Jesus. But here are these two blind men. Go, that's the Son of David. Now, we don't have time for the whole thing, but if you go back to the Old Testament, this is Messiah language. David in 2 Samuel chapter 7 has made a promise by God. There's a couple big promises. If you ever go to Bible school, they will just be pounded into you. You will not come out of Bible school without knowing Genesis 12, 2 Samuel chapter 7. First one made to Abraham, that God's going to make him into a great nation. The second one made to David. And it's a weird promise because you're reading through the whole thing and it doesn't sound spectacular until the very final phrase. God comes to David and says, hey, David, after you, your son's going to be on your throne. It's going to be a great kingdom. Like, well, what's so amazing about that? I mean, that kind of goes without saying. If you're a king in the ancient world, that's just how it worked. Your oldest son was on the throne. Like, why would God promise? It's because of the very last phrase. And his kingdom will be an eternal kingdom. They go, hold on a second. How can a king have an eternal kingdom? Because we die. And that's the promise. That's the shocking part of God saying, David, one day, someone's coming after you, your son, who will reign forever. And the Jewish people knew it was not Solomon. He died. So they were looking for one who's they labeled that the Messiah. He is the anointed one, the one promised by God. And he will one day come and he will restore us to Jerusalem. And we will go up to the city and he will reign forever. And these two blind men are like, it's him. It's him. And he's standing right there. They know that of him and they know one other thing of him. He's merciful. He's not the kind of king that sits up on a throne and has everyone grovel before him. Notice they cry out, Son of David, have mercy on us. Isn't it awesome? They are aware that this great king is different than the kings of this world. He's not a king that measures greatness by how many people serve him, but by how many people he serves. And they know it. The lights come on. Matthew wants you to see it. Matthew wants you to see a third thing. He wants you again to hold up two blind men next to two other men. They're actually right there just a few verses before. The mother named, sort of the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John, her name is Salome, who actually will show up, and I don't think we talked about this much in second service last week. She shows up at the cross, interestingly enough. She's there. She's actually the last one named in the list of people who were at the cross watching Jesus crucified between a thief on his right and a thief on the left. But before that, she had asked Jesus for something. She wanted her sons to sit on two thrones, one on the left and one on the right. And I've often wondered to myself, when she stood at the cross that day, did she connect the dots of what she had asked just a few days before and what she was watching happen before her eyes? I don't know the answer to that. But what I want you to see in verse 21 is that Jesus asks her a question. And I think this is Matthew's way of saying, I want you to think of two disciples and two soon-to-be disciples, both being asked a question. What do you want? We want thrones. What do you want? We want mercy. In fact, it's actually a little different than that. It's let our eyes be opened. Now, on the one hand, that seems like the most obvious thing in the world. In fact, in that second story, it actually almost maybe at first glance seems like a really strange question. Why would Jesus even have to ask? Like, doesn't it go without saying? Isn't it obvious? Two blind men standing before you and you ask them, what do you want? Like, really, Jesus? Like, wouldn't you have just intuitively known? I think he wants to hear their answer. Because if you stop and think about the answer to that question for a moment, you actually will really quickly realize it's a very strange answer. Just imagine the situation for a second. It's not probably going to happen, but imagine two blind men came up to you and they said, or you said to them, what do you want? What do you think they might say? I think if they came to me, I would probably think it would be something like this. Well, the one thing I know you can't do is the thing I most desperately need, because no one can give me my sight back. So what do I want? Well, I've been sitting here at the side of the road begging, and every once in a while I get a little bit. And it would sure be a help if you just did more than what other people have been able to do. What do I want? It's like, if you could put enough money in that little box right there that I could stay fed for a week or a month, I'll call that a win. But to entertain the thought that you would actually ask someone to open your eyes, what does that mean that they believe about Jesus? Because no one else in human history has had that ability. It seems to me very close to a pretty clear confession that they believe that they are kneeling in the dirt before God. What do you want? I want you to open my eyes. Now, very different requests. The disciples are after glory. They want thrones. Two blind men are just after mercy. As I was working through this, I thought to myself, you know what? You will never know the right question or the right answer or right question, sorry, to ask God until you know who he is. Like, until you know who Jesus is, you will not ask him for the right things. And he invites us to. But what do you ask of him if you know he's God? If you know you have the permission to ask God something, do you really ask for a pony? Do you really ask to get over a cold? Or do you cry out, it's like, Lord, I have an eternal problem. I am so broken and full of sin that unless you can forgive me and cleanse me, I have no hope. But until you know who he is, you will not ask the right questions. These guys know who he is. They ask the right questions. That's the third thing. Last, real quick. I think Matthew puts this story here to help us see that unless God works, we will not see. Don't have time for it, but you could go back and just sometimes if you want to just do a fun little study, just search the Old Testament of references around the issue of blindness. God's the one who restores sight to the blind. And it's a struggle all through the Old Testament. Lots of Psalms talk about it. The prophets talk about it. Like God shows up and does something where he gives sight to the blind. Elisha prays one day that his servant will be allowed to see. And he's like, God, open his eyes. That's God does this. And I think there's this story put here so that we understand that Jesus is talking about his kingdom and the values of his kingdom. His disciples don't get it. They don't see. And then Jesus shows up. And when God shows up, sight's possible. I need to flip to this page because I won't remember the numbers. I Googled facts about the sun. Here we go, real quick. We are in the closing lap. The sun is 74.9% hydrogen, 23.8% helium. Those don't weigh very much. 2% other stuff. And yet, the sun contains over 99% of all the mass of our entire solar system. Like that little 2% bit left over is more than everything else. You can fit 1.3 million Earths inside the sun. At its core, it's burning at a temperature of over 15 million degrees centigrade. I don't know how they know that. I don't think they did like one of those probe temperatures. At its surface, we know it's around 6,000 Celsius. That is awesome. The amount of power it's producing is the equivalent of 10 billion nuclear bombs going off every second. Just to keep that thing fired up the way it looks up in the sky. And once upon a time, there was no sun. Until God said, let there be light. And there was light. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6, Paul is teaching us about what happened the day when you saw. When the eyes of your heart saw. And he says, the same God who said, let there be light, said to your heart, let there be vision, perception, understanding of who I am. And the way Paul's arguing, he's saying like the same, it took the same power. It took 10 billion nuclear bombs every second. The power that could do that so that you could see. And I think that's where we want to end this morning. The understanding that for you to be able to see and understand who Jesus is was not your smarts. It was not your ability. You didn't read the book and wrestle it out. Once, the same God who said, let there be light, shone into your heart and said, I want you to see the glory of my son. And two blind men on the side of the road who couldn't see a thing, could see. And I trust you do as well.